before it arrived, the health of Americans was already on a par with low and middle income nations. Public health folk in other countries laughed at us for being dead first. We must support early life, the period when half of our health as adults is programmed. We must drastically reduce inequality, and we must implement universal health care. If we undertake these plans in the months ahead, the effect will last decades, if not centuries. We must not let this pandemic go to waste, but use it to catapult us into a new way of being.
That's Dr. Stephen Bezruchka, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Dr. Stephen Bezruchka on consequences of COVID-19. What kind of bizarre Twilight Zone world are we in? It's surreal. The coronavirus pandemic is a global altering event. It has exposed huge fissures of vulnerability. The dead from COVID-19 in the United States now exceeds Vietnam War levels. The health crisis has triggered an economic crisis. Tens of millions have lost their jobs in the largest mass unemployment since the Great Depression. The breadlines of the 1930s have turned into car lines as people wait for hours to get some free food. The lack of preparation, the shortages of tests and medical equipment, plus all the dissembling, has been mind-boggling. "I don't take any responsibility at all," intones the president. What will emerge from this pandemic emergency? A more equitable, decent society living in harmony with the earth, or more rapacious, destructive capitalism? The choice is clear. Our guest today is Dr. Stephen Bezruchka. He's on the faculty of the Department of Global Health and the Department of Health Services at the University of Washington. He worked for many years as an emergency physician in Seattle. He spoke from his home in Seattle in late April. And now, Dr. Stephen Bezruchka.
There are decades when nothing seems to happen, and there are weeks when decades happen. The current pandemic is likely to be the most important event of our lives. COVID-19, the disease is reshaping the world as we know it and will continue to do so for many years. We must not let this pandemic go to waste. I recorded two virtual talks for Alternative Radio about coronavirus in March 2020, where the opportunity was afforded me by the cancellation of my classroom teaching at the University of Washington. During this time, there's been an explosion of information, fake news, alternative facts, and outright lies in the media's pandemic 24-hour bombardment of our sense organs, a kaleidoscopic assault against few of which have herd immunity. This has produced stress and fear everywhere in society. In this talk, I will present my perspective in the hope that I will get your critical thinking skills working to take the best next steps. What we do together now may be the most important struggles of our lives. In my first AR talk, I said that every illness is there to teach you something. In the second talk, I exposed our capitalist political economic system as not being up to the challenges we are facing. Now I want to explain why economic growth, for growth's sake, the ideology of the cancer cell, is not good for us. Not for us as human beings, nor for our spaceship Earth. This pandemic has not spared the richest and most powerful country in world history. We are leading the world in something awful. It is hard not to cry. In the previous two AR talks, I suggested that our current COVID-19 crisis resulted from the rapacious capitalism that has destroyed natural habitats and created conditions facilitating yet another virus jumping from other animals, in this case bats, who have evolved a fierce immune response to viruses. These viruses need to replicate quickly to get past the bat's strong defense reaction. They are then likely to spread to an intermediate animal with a less robust immune reaction, now thought to be a pangolin in China. The SARS-CoV-2 virus was inhaled by a human and lodged in the respiratory system to infect cells there. Viruses proliferate by making their host cells to make many copies that kill the cell, which then bursts to spread the infection to other cells in that person's respiratory tract. This infection in humans is mostly mild and doesn't kill the person like other viruses such as SARS. But a cough or sneeze can expel viruses to infect others in a similar fashion. Sometimes it may spread down into a person's lungs, where the body's response, termed a cytokine storm, can run out of control to kill the hapless victim. The highest transmission of SARS-CoV-2 likely occurs in dense crowds with much merrymaking. Mardi Gras in New Orleans on February 25th had millions of people gathered to celebrate, jostling, dancing, hugging, sharing cups while eating and drinking together. Small droplets, termed fomites, from infected airway passages easily landed on others to get inside the body through the respiratory tree. The tourist crowd, estimated to be 1.4 million people, then returned home to other regions and continents. The cluster bombs at Mardi Gras presented the perfect storm. When a novel infection appears, such as AIDS or SARS or MERS, initially authorities tend to deny it is significant. An astute doctor in Wuhan, China, suspected in November that patients with serious symptoms were heralding a new disease. His concern was dismissed and he was ostracized. But in 2 weeks' time, the Chinese government responded with a shutdown of society, which involved massive testing and the quarantining of citizens. By mid-March, active cases there had plummeted. However, before the closure on New Year's Eve, some 430,000 people had flown to the U.S. from China, many directly from Wuhan. In the U.S., we heard of these bizarre news stories and never imagined anything serious could happen here. By contrast, in South Korea, they began early testing, contact tracing, and quarantining. By early March, they were administering 600 times more tests per million people than we were. On January 22nd, our leader said, quote, "We had it pretty much under control," end of quote. Some conservative media networks use the term pandemic to downplay the scourge we are experiencing today. The first U.S. case of COVID-19 may have occurred in the state of Washington in late February 2020 from someone returning from China, although it appears the infection landed in California earlier. A healthcare worker at a Washington state nursing home was the first American to die, soon followed by many others. Our president dismissed the burgeoning pandemic, but on Friday the 13th, March 2020, he declared a national emergency and promised aid to states in the form of sick pay and food assistance. A calendar of our president's statements of denial to that time became a much-shared video in China. We were a laughingstock. Don't speak of information going viral again. For the last month, there has been a quarantine that reflects physical distancing. The phrase social distancing is being incorrectly used. For many of us, there is less social distancing despite being physically apart. Many institutions are closed, especially businesses not selling essential goods. As well, sporting and entertainment events have been canceled. Schools, parks and recreational facilities, factories are shuttered. Some are supposedly retooling their production lines to make masks or ventilators, which should have not been necessary if we were prepared for the certainty of a viral invasion. In America, we have increased military spending, supposedly to protect us. Yet over the last few years, we've curtailed spending for pandemic preparedness. It's unlikely that the military can fight to save us. The media only focus on COVID-19, minute-by-minute reports. We must limit our sensory organs to these evil tidings if we are to survive emotionally. Nevertheless, we must examine how we're doing as a country. We have 4 times as many cases as the next country. We have a commanding lead in the COVID-19 Olympics, whether ranked by cases or deaths. Our team leader is New York State, with over 15,000 deaths in New York City alone. And these numbers are surely an undercount, as people are dying at home rather than seeking medical care. Why is New York City the epicenter in the country, in fact, in the entire world? More deaths per capita than in all of Italy. SARS-CoV-2 infections in the Northeast likely came from Europe than from Asia. It is said that people not infected with the virus have died in greater numbers in New York because the overwhelmed medical care system couldn't take care of them. As in Chicago and other big cities, the extreme inequality and racism there are likely major factors. New York has the highest income inequality among U.S. states. We spoke about this in the previous talk, namely that inequality is the major killer. Blacks and Latinx are the hardest hit. They have a greater exposure to the virus from the essential jobs they do. They can't self-quarantine, and they need to ride the subways and other public incubators to get to work. Blacks have an innate health disadvantage that goes back to slavery as the reason for their being more susceptible. What can be learned from other cities where we might have expected a similar death toll? Consider San Francisco, only a handful. What are the reasons for this? California was the first to issue stay-at-home orders. Another reason might be the solitary car culture in California and the lack of public transportation, which is the major conveyor in New York. The lack of large apartment complexes in California contrasts with that of New York. This lack of cluster bombing in California may be an advantage. The coronavirus pandemic is a form of structural violence. The threat is invisible unless you're a scientist tracking the culprit microscopically. SARS-CoV-2, the virus, has infiltrated humans on the planet. Either you've died from COVID-19 or recovered, or fear the virus, especially from the constant media hype about it, and you are stressed out. Our response to the invisible form of structural violence, the COVID-19 pandemic, varies. The poor are the most affected. Many of them who were lucky enough to have jobs to support their families have now lost them. Their situation is much more precarious. Consider the non-poor, the middle class, which in this country is the smallest of all rich countries. How are they doing? Many who have small businesses, like Andra, a former student of mine who runs a physical therapy clinic, have had to lay off workers. She's left with a few patients whom she meets on a park bench as they sit physically apart. She feels compassion for their pain issues and offers succor. Her former employees now do with less and suffer increased stress for themselves and their families. At least they have roofs over their head, and benevolent banks are delaying mortgage payments while landlords are holding back on collecting rent. There's a brief moratorium on evictions. The real heroes and heroines today are the dedicated healthcare workers on the front lines. First responders, paramedics, and others risk becoming infected. Next on the firing line are those in the hospitals who treat COVID-19 patients, as well as the caregivers in nursing homes and rehabilitation centers. We do not have a national testing and tracing program for healthcare workers, nor for those doing essential work. we must institute such testing and tracing immediately through an executive order. What about the rich? The rich have no financial problems, but they are concerned that their wealth may decline. Recall that the rich and powerful have only wanted one thing throughout history: more. They will do all they can to achieve this. After the last crisis in 2008 and 9, their wealth share dropped a little, but since then and until now, they have more than recovered their losses to reach record levels of affluence. Their mechanisms in recent centuries were mostly to use socialism to bail out capitalism when it got into trouble. That is, costs were socialized and profits were privatized. Everyone's a socialist in today's pandemic. We can't depend on capitalism and are bailing out corporations right and left. Ordinary folk bear the burden, while some of the rich go to their island getaways. Others go to hide in Teton County, Wyoming, which has the largest gap between the 1% and the rest of us, as well as the highest per capita income, considerably higher than Manhattan. The phrase flattening the curve means that the rate, the number of new infections, begins to peak and decline. It is abundantly clear that we're nowhere near that point. Towards the end of April, we may have reached the peak of the curve, but the decline is negligible. It took South Korea about 2 months to flatten its curve with their testing, isolation, and surveillance. Koreans trust their government and were willing to go along. We have much less trust in our leader. Our ability to find those with SARS-CoV-2 infections will be difficult. Testing is still limited, and many people will not seek it out, learning whether or not they have the virus. The undocumented don't want any interaction with authorities for fear of being deported. The homeless struggle every day anyway. Many with health care insurance fear being straddled with more bills they can't pay. Testing is now supposed to be free, and some healthcare insurance companies are waiving costs associated with treatment. But hospitals are billing $100,000 or more for the care received, and there's piecemeal support from the government. Beyond the disease, millions are now unemployed and facing dire circumstances. More unemployed in this country are applying for assistance than during the Great Depression. This is happening in an economy that our president recently touted as the best ever. For those who have jobs, still, there is hope of sick leave and other benefits. You have to remember that we have the worst system of financial and social support for workers of all rich nations. There won't be a New Deal unless we prepare this country for one. African Americans and American Indians are much more affected by the pandemic than other groups. The New York Times headline April 8th said, "Black Americans bear the brunt as deaths climb." They've borne the brunt since slavery on any measure of health. Why is this news now? In Milwaukee County, Wisconsin, over four-fifths of the deaths are among blacks, who comprise a much smaller proportion of residents. African Americans are less likely to seek treatment, as they have been taken advantage of in the past. Consider the Tuskegee study, where instead of treating syphilis in blacks after penicillin was found to be effective, researchers left them without therapy to study the end stages of the disease. No wonder blacks can't trust the government. Another is the use of cells from African Americans without their permission, as described in Rebecca Skloot's bestseller, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. Expect the poor and people of color to suffer more from coronavirus. Our healthcare system is in shambles, yet we spend more on healthcare than the rest of the world combined. In 2019, this was $3.8 trillion out of an economy of $21 trillion, or almost a fifth of the entire country's spending. We had 5% growth over the previous year. Yet we lack doctors, hospital beds, ventilators, medicines, diagnostic testing, and protective equipment, things other nations have been able to provide at much lower cost. Our for-profit medical care system has failed us. Public health has also failed the country. For decades before the current crisis, it has been asleep at the switch and not alerting us or acting upon our declining health status. We are dead first. What is happening in poor countries, where most lethal infectious diseases such as malaria and tuberculosis, which kill the most, still reside? Low and middle income countries have reported few cases compared to richer ones. Why? Some argue that tropical and semi-tropical countries have warmer climates at present that might inhibit viral transmission. Most of today's cases are in the northern latitudes where winter prevailed until recently. Colder weather draws people together more. Also, poorer countries may have vastly underreported cases as they have few resources and not many healthcare workers to diagnose the disease or administer tests. Among such nations, Brazil has high numbers of cases. The elite or super rich there are concerned as there have been outbreaks in the presidential palace and at an exclusive country club. Eventually, it will be the poor and black masses who will suffer most. Many poor countries have instituted lockdowns with curfews and given police license to control behavior that has resulted in wanton killing by police of the poor and vulnerable, such as in India, where Modi, the prime minister, has mandated a lockdown. India's healthiest state, Kerala, was the first to report a COVID case in late January. It flattened its coronavirus curve quickly. The proactive communist government in Kerala did aggressive testing, contact tracing, as well as food distribution to those in need. Their government announced an economic package to fight the pandemic days before the Modi government instituted the harsh lockdown. In the Philippines, curfew violators are placed in dog cages. Starvation looms on the horizon in countries such as Zimbabwe, where lockdowns close banks, then cannot dispense pensions. Malawi, a poor country in East Africa, can only test 20 people a day. It has but 7 ventilators for the whole nation. So far, it has few cases and no deaths. Where are we in the United States today? We have the most cases, most deaths, and twice as many as Italy, where the pandemic first raged in Europe. There is a national lack of leadership about the pandemic. People are frightened. In times of crisis, we want to trust a leader. He received alerts both early and often. Our Teflon president takes all the credit for everything and leaves all the blame to others. We have no coordinated response. Our capacity to deal with the infection is woefully inadequate. Capitalism, with its profit and rent-seeking, has led us to this abyss. Where are we people heading? In the process of reacting to coronavirus, we've learned to adapt, some of us in positive ways and others in ways that are not so positive. What are possible scenarios? Let's explore some in the short term and then farther out. The COVID crisis has its silver linings. For people like me, who have somewhat secure employment, we are coping and some of us may even be thriving. I'm teaching online, virtually, but it is possible, indeed likely, that at some point in the future this process will be automated or at least outsourced for cheaper labor. Will hands-on examining of a sick patient similarly become unnecessary as telemedicine becomes the norm? Nursing homes use robots to comfort and provide pseudo-friendship to inmates. Even before the current coronavirus, work had become precarious. Despite the call for social isolation or social distancing, we're getting together in novel ways. This is happening for those of us privileged to be somewhat less afraid. Murders and homicides are down. We've seen a decrease in air pollution, with fewer vehicles on roads. There are also reduced emissions of global warming gases. We're producing less garbage. This includes plastics and a variety of chemicals that corporations release into the environment. These benefits are accruing without harming us. Workers in a variety of businesses are pressing for unionization by revolting. Trader Joe's, for example, is anti-union, as are most commercial entities in the United States, the country with the lowest unionization rate of all rich nations. Such uprisings point out what is broken in the United States, namely the ability to have justice in the workplace. How about negative consequences? There's so much waste in the way food is produced. This results in much produce, milk, and other forms of nutrition being destroyed. For example, 3.7 million gallons of milk a day in the United States are being destroyed because it can't be sold. Cows need to be milked several times a day, whether or not there are buyers. Farming groups are lobbying pizza chains to put more cheese on every takeout slice. The same is true for vegetables and fruit. This despite empty store shelves. The reason? For every product, we need a buyer and a producer. We have plenty of food producers, but with restaurants, hotels, and schools closed, there are no buyers for these products. People are eating at home and need less food. We eat more vegetables and we go to restaurants, but now they are being plowed into the soil. Veggies could go to our food banks that have diminishing supplies, but there are fewer volunteers to help out there. Food banks are hurting. Stop and consider that amidst this plenty, we have a huge industry of food banks, institutions that distribute food to so many people. This in the richest and most powerful country in world history. We could be exporting food to poor countries that are much closer to starvation than we are, but there's no mechanism to do so. Similarly, one chicken processor is smashing 750,000 unhatched eggs every week as fewer chickens are needed. Everywhere we see massive changes in our economy that could make things better for many if we had the wherewithal to act differently. Or perhaps it is just a reflection of how crazy and unsustainable our lives are. Domestic violence is up, as is child abuse, because people who normally have ways of keeping distance, children and adults, or women and their partners, find it more difficult being together. Mental illness is increasing. Reasons include loneliness and stress. You can find much advice on how to deal with stress today. One of the aspects of being stressed out is feeling out of control or powerless. We've given up what small amount of power we had. Mind you, if it is for the common good, then it is worth it.
You're listening to Dr. Stephen Bezruchka on consequences of COVID-19. This is Independent Alternative Radio. In solidarity with you, our listeners, we're offering this program at no charge. If you'd like a transcript copy of Dr. Stephen Bezruchka, Consequences of COVID-19, just call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can go to our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
Loneliness is a big killer. We've known this scientifically since 1979, when Lisa Berkman and Len Syme looked at relationships in Alameda County, California. Those without family and friends were much more likely to die. Lack of such social support is worse for health than smoking close to a pack of cigarettes a day. As a nation, we are far behind others in addressing the scourge of modern society. The United Kingdom has a ministry of loneliness. Ways of coping. Now many of us are podcasting, but not enough are pod listening. Let's do both so communication is a two-way street. Give yourself the therapy you can and avoid the collective paralysis so many of us feel. Short-term consequences. The experience we are having right now may be the most significant event of your life, so you better figure out what you're going to do and what you will tell your descendants before you die. Assessment of the COVID pandemic varies tremendously around the world. What I experience is going to be very different from what frontline healthcare workers in the trenches experience. For them, it might be like the trenches in World War I. Those who have to warehouse corpses are likely to despair. What about the millions of workers who no longer have a job? The myriad who remain unhoused or homeless? Then those who have very precarious work, and those who may be exposed to the virus unknowingly from their work and other activities. To many, the pandemic is like this talk, virtual, or better still, concealed. You only know about it from the media, from the absence of traffic on the streets, from buildings and businesses being shuttered, from not going shopping at the store, for not being able to get together physically with your friends. My wife and I celebrated a good friend's 60th birthday recently online. While the experience was pleasurable, it lacked the intimacy of singing happy birthday physically together, then cutting and eating the cake. The shelter-in-place effect in Seattle has been phenomenal. Surveillance capitalism has been tracking our movements via smartphones. Between February 28th and March 27th, our personal daily travel fell from an average of 3.8 miles to just 61 feet. By way of contrast, in Daytona Beach, Florida, it fell from 4.4 miles to 1.9 miles. There are more deaths in Florida than in Washington State. Floridians have been less cautious. We are responding in ways that would have been unthinkable outside of a war effort where bombs destroy buildings and people. Recall our invading Iraq in 2003. We destroyed large parts of the country and killed more than a million people, all on the pretext that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. The consequences have been the rise of terrorism around the world, jihadist terrorism and other varieties. Yet global surveys reveal that more people around the world consider the United States the most terrorist country. We have had a payback, giving us a more dangerous world for all. 2 points here. We must be very careful of any national responses, and we need to see our responses within the United States as part of a war effort towards a very strong attacker. The SARS-CoV-2 virus that causes COVID-19, the disease. So far, this assailant hasn't brought down buildings, just overwhelmed the morgues. Headlines in newspapers have been the most continuously alarming I've ever seen in my 77 years, such as sales at U.S. stores hit catastrophic depths, or job losses soar, U.S. virus cases top world, or pandemic tempts leaders to seize sweeping powers. The media have exhausted such horrible news banners. What more outrageous story is there to tell us to make us more afraid? Inciting fear is the best way to control us. Once the quarantine is lifted, many of us will be reluctant to go back to the way life used to be, even if that were possible. We are wary of the safety of workplaces and society out there. We don't want to be lemmings rushing to the cliff. The opening of businesses will take varying timelines. Facebook has said it is canceling all planned physical events with 50 or more attendees until June 2021. we shouldn't be in a hurry to get back to business as usual. We need to rethink our economic system. It may take us a few years to get back to where we were, or we can decide on a different path. What might that be? One is the distinctly un-American idea of learning from others, from other nations as to what they do. In Europe, there isn't the same crisis of unemployment and stark headlines of looming disaster. Why? They have different systems. In Western Europe, governments pay a large portion of wages when the employees aren't working, such as now. Consider that in this economic downturn, governments are paying workers' salaries even when they're not at work to keep morale up. Spain is instituting a universal basic income. Getting things moving is starting in Europe, but there are precedents on how to proceed. For a business to start up, say one that produces widgets, it needs to know that there will be orders for these widgets. If the orders aren't forthcoming, what happens? Well, it's easier in Europe to proceed since they have done much more coronavirus testing and contact tracing than we have. They have a better sense of what the chances of further spread of SARS-CoV-2 are. They also have a greater stock of personal protective devices than we do. And European countries enjoy a high level of decentralization, in which European officials have the autonomy to decide on what to fund to make the choices work. Recall, we depend on capitalism to have on hand what we need and want to buy. But there was no stockpiling of such items as masks, ventilators, and gloves for a viral day. There was no profit in that, so this hasn't been done. Our government didn't want to interfere in profiting by big business. No matter what, the cooperation among nations is at a very low point. And, at least in the United States, there is little cooperation between epidemiologists, those folk that study and understand epidemics, and economists or politicians, at least at the national level. We might end up taking one step forward and then two steps back. It's not going to be smooth. Let's consider a variety of options and embrace innovative thinking. One option is to have more worker-run businesses. In Italy, a law passed in 1985, the Marcora Law, is to be used in crisis situations. It works when you become unemployed and are covered by the generous Italian unemployment benefits that give you compensation for a year or more. Those who become unemployed can organize together to start a worker cooperative that is funded by the unemployment benefits they all were to receive. The idea is to transfer businesses to employees in order to avoid closing them. We could do that here. Worker strikes are another option, one that worked during the Great Depression. If those providing essential services were to go on strike, especially those deprived of personal protective equipment, much would change. Grocery workers, fire departments, hospital staff, first responders, sanitation workers, and others we depend on these days. I know what you're thinking. But we need them. Do we need them to die because of their job taking care of us? Long-term consequences. We don't yet know what will be written to show how we responded to this pandemic in future history books. What can be learned from the past before we try to predict the future today? Major events that have changed the world in the last century include the Treaty of Versailles, concluding World War I, that saw the end of several empires and set the stage for Germany's Third Reich and the rise of Hitler. None of us were there then. Then the so-called Spanish flu of 1918. it's likely to have originated in Kansas among the military, was a major killer at that time. But we mostly forgot about it and didn't learn the necessary lessons. Nor were we there for the Great Depression following the stock market collapse in 1929. The Depression led to the New Deal, which included a minimum wage, a job creation program, the strengthening of labor unions, Social Security, and many other benefits. Although those benefits are still with us in skeleton form, the rise of neoliberalism has emaciated them. World War II changed the world in many significant ways. In particular, it created institutions such as the United Nations to prevent future world wars, together with the World Bank for Reconstruction and Development, just called the World Bank today, and the International Monetary Fund. Our decision to drop two atomic bombs on Japan spawned a nuclear arms race in the Cold War. The self-serving mantra that we dropped the bombs to save lives is nonsense. Japan had already indicated its willingness to surrender on the condition that we don't execute their emperor. Our leader dropped the bombs to show the Soviet Union how powerful we were. That triggered the nuclear arms race, and the consequences today remain very threatening to life on the planet. The Cold War successfully instilled fear of communism and socialism on the American public. And people are much more easily controlled if they're afraid. The first major event of my adult life was the U.S. invasion of Vietnam in the 1960s under entirely false pretenses. I thought the government was there to serve the people, but I learned that wasn't the case. I was forced to develop my own perspective of how the world works. I continue to critically reevaluate my thoughts as events evolved. I've concluded that most institutions exist to serve the rich and powerful. That isn't something taught in schools. The fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989 and the collapse of the Soviet Union 2 years later ended the Cold War and left the United States the world's only superpower. Our response to the collapse of the World Trade Towers in 2001 was to invade two countries innocent of the crime, namely Afghanistan and Iraq. On a lesser scale, the 2008-09 global banking crisis presented another opportunity that we failed to learn from as we bailed out the rich again. Instead, we entered a phase of hypercapitalism, establishing extreme income and wealth inequality never before seen on the planet. We're in the process of reducing greenhouse gases with less CO2 emission. Oil prices have dropped as Saudi Arabia and Russia waged a price war to cash in on the remaining fossil fuels before we switch to cleaner energy. They have agreed to drop oil production to protect the market during this pandemic. But despite cheap energy, we're not consuming the oil the way we used to. For the first time in history, oil prices went negative in futures markets. Oil sellers will almost pay buyers to take their supply. Oil is being stored anywhere there is space, on barges, for example. Because room for oil is fast disappearing. Refineries similarly don't want to produce petroleum products such as gasoline as people are not commuting, taking airplane flights, and international trade has declined. This remarkable development heralds progress in stemming fossil fuel use and establishing renewable energy sources. The coronavirus pandemic will lead to profound changes in how the world works that can't be predicted at present. That depends on what we the people do as we go forward. Economic inequality is going to decline after this pandemic. The question is whether we will allow it to be restored to the record levels present before the crisis. After the subprime mortgage crisis in 2008, Income and wealth inequality declined a bit, but after government bailouts, it soared to new highs. We must not let that happen again. Doing so requires creating widespread awareness of how our current problems have been precipitated by economic inequality. This will require a huge effort. Would an economic depression be good for us? The International Monetary Fund predicts the worst economic slump since the Great Depression. The economy is contracting, that is, economic growth is slowing or reversing, meaning that we are in a recession, which may likely turn out to be a depression. A genuine economic depression is defined as a recession lasting two or more years, or a decline in GDP exceeding 10%. Is this what is in store? It is unlikely that any federal stimulus package will change this picture that is a built-in feature of the normal business cycle of capitalism. Is there gold at the end of the collapsing rainbow? Yes. Brace yourself for another amazing finding. Although this may sound heretical, sometimes things get better when they get worse. Paradoxically, mortality has been found to be pro-cyclical, namely it follows the business cycle. When business is booming, mortality is likely to increase, and when the economy is contracting, the opposite happens, namely mortality declines. I first became aware of this considering the 2008-09 economic crisis. The phenomenon was first reported by Dorothy Thomas in 1922 in a statistical journal and in her 1925 book, but it received little attention. It has been confirmed by many subsequent studies. Some who believe in endless economic growth have called this association perverse. Studies of the Great Depression in the U.S. found mortality decreasing with strong gains in life expectancy over the period 1930 to 1933. The only exception was the suicide rate, which increased. We could add the Spanish flu of 1918 to the Great Depression of 1929 to get to our situation in 2020. The pandemic and economic contraction could lead to an improvement in overall health, despite the increased deaths from COVID-19. It's too early for definitive findings, but there are preliminary hints that this is going on now. Economic expansions, then, are associated with increasing mortality. Reasons include the stress associated with trying to work ever harder at multiple jobs to cash in on the boom. Traffic crash deaths go up as road rage prevails when you hurry to your second job. Stress reduces immunity. There's less time for sleep and for being with family, as well as increased consumption of alcohol and other nefarious substances. The strength of the effect appears to vary among countries. In nations where highs and lows of the boom-bust cycles are smoothed out by high levels of social spending, the economy has less impact on mortality, whereas those with limited social spending, such as the United States, suffer worse consequences. Now we need to consider what economic growth is doing to us in rich countries. I said growth for growth's sake is the ideology of the cancer cell. Is that what we want with economic growth? Economic growth is killing us. It produces wealth, which leads to devastation, which today is represented by COVID-19. For nations with a GDP less than around $10,000 per capita, shared economic growth to that level improves standards of well-being. Those economies should grow. The expected depression should present a global stimulus to redirect societal goals. A good slogan for such a realignment is, "Mind the gap," the warning sign next to the tracks in every London tube or subway station. For us, it should be a reminder to level the playing field in order to reduce inequality from today's record highs. Pandemics can rebalance societies. After the Black Death in England, the king issued an ordinance with a maximum wage law to decrease inequality. We have a similar golden opportunity today. We must not let this pandemic go to waste, but use it to catapult us into a new way of being. Our society will be massively restructured after this scourge ends or quiets down in a year or more. Will those in power command even more of the planetary resources to lord it over us as they laud their accomplishments, first getting us into this quandary and then taking credit for positive outcomes? Or will we, the people, in our search for a better society, recognize that we need to cast off the cancerous economic growth engine and find one that gives us healthier lives, a more stable planet, and a better home for all the species that share it with us? Yes, viruses are all around us, but the chances of their infecting us increased as we destroyed the habitat of other animals and plants through massive environmental deforestation, which I see as the most upstream cause of our current dilemma. Right now, we need to enhance our social embrace while we increase our physical distance. Afterwards, we must come together and understand the power dynamics that have brought us to this situation and change the predicament for the better. The rich and powerful, who number at most a few million globally, are no match for the 7 billion of us once we flex our collective muscle. We must resume peaceful protests. Later, let us amass huge numbers together, say a 2 million-person event on the Mall in Washington, D.C. Similar responses are needed in Europe and East Asia. This would be democracy in action. We need a global democracy movement that places power in the hands of the people, not only in the political realm, but in the workplace and other parts of our lives. There is a democracy movement in Europe that needs to go global. The Another World is Possible World Social Forum efforts that began in 2001 must evolve to produce international cooperation as never seen before. The Progressive International attempts to mobilize people around the world to transform the global order and the institutions that shape it exist. We have begun. To recapitulate, we must not waste this pandemic. Before it arrived, the health of Americans was already on a par with low and middle income nations. Public health folk in other countries laughed at us for being dead first. We must support early life, the period when half of our health as adults is programmed. We must drastically reduce inequality, and we must implement universal health care. The way to instill these goals into the national psyche is to develop a new curriculum based on creating a healthy society and then require public school teachers to teach to the test about health in America. If we undertake these plans in the months ahead, the effect will last decades, if not centuries. Business as usual is not an option. If you're not at the table, you may be on the menu. Don't be missing an action. Thank you for listening.
That was Dr. Stephen Bezruchka on consequences of COVID-19. He spoke from his home in Seattle in late April. Dr. Stephen Bezruchka is on the faculty of the Department of Global Health and the Department of Health Services at the University of Washington. This program is produced by Alternative Radio based in Boulder, Colorado. We are an independent, progressive nonprofit. Now in our 34th year, we are supported solely by individuals just like you. To access our complete audio archive, and we have a series of programs with Dr. Bezruchka, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. Due to the current crisis and wanting to do our part in solidarity with you, our listeners, we're offering a free transcript of today's program, Dr. Stephen Bezruchka, on consequences of COVID-19. To get a copy, just call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Our website is alternativeradio.org. Again, our website, alternativeradio.org. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with Thelonious Monk, Straight, No Chaser.